Here is your moderator, Gail Nomura.
Welcome to our session on East of the Exclusion Zone. My name is Gail Nomura. I teach at the University of Washington, Department of American Ethnic Studies. On our panel, we have our two speakers, Shizue Watanabe and Linda Tamura. Let me introduce Shiz first. Shiz was a senior at Dawson County High School in Montana when World War II broke out in 1942. So she will tell us about living in Montana, east of the exclusion zone. I should have just a short background that Shiz's parents were Harry and Sumako Kawamoto Nakanishi. Her mother passed away from complications from childbirth shortly after she was born. And so she was taken in or fostered or taken in by the Shiomi couple family who did not have any children. And they moved to Glendive, Montana in 1930 and raised her as their own daughter there. So that is why she is in Montana at this point in time. Shiz is a very, very active member of our Japanese-American community in Seattle and volunteers in I don't know how many. I think every day is taken up with another volunteer thing at Nikkei Manor and at the Japanese Cultural and Community Center in Washington, at church, and I don't know what. I can't get a hold of her because she's always volunteering somewhere. So let me introduce Shiz.
Hello, everybody. My name is Shizue Watanabe. And when Japan bombed Pearl Harbor and Hawaii was announced over the radio in 1942, we were all shocked. My parents and I were the only three people living in Glendive, Montana. So we didn't know what the heck was going on. And then my father was a cook in Seattle, but he got transferred to Glendive, Montana. So I was living there since I was 5 years old, and we moved out when in 1946 when I was 21. I was a senior in Dawson County High School. After graduation, I went to work at a dry cleaning shop doing special ironing for fancy party dresses and fancy curtains for the rich people. Being the youngest person working there, the co-workers gave me the baby nickname Baby Snooks. That was very popular in those days. And they could say Shizue. Then my name changed to Snooky, so I've always been called Snooky during my working days. Then one day, I heard the hospital looking for workers, so I applied and got hired right away. I was preparing the special diet for the lunches and dinners for the special patients. I also served the doctors and nurses, which was lots of fun there. Then one day, the doctor asked me if I would like to become a nurse's aide, because all the nurses had gone off to war and they're short on nurse's aide. I said, well, I guess I'll try it. So I went to the training and became a nurse's aide, and I loved that job. I started at 6:30 in the morning. I'd bring the wash basin to the patients so they could wash their faces, and their kids, I used to help them wash their face and give them a bed bath. But one day, I was given the bath to one of the Northern Pacific patients that was there, and I started to wash him because he couldn't wash himself. He said, hey, you started washing me. How about finishing your job? I said, my face got red, I guess. Quit your blushing. Anyway, I loved that job. And then the next thing, another doctor asked me, I noticed you at nurse's aide, and I want to know if you would like to become a nurse. I said, no, I can't take the patients. So I just stayed at a nurse's aide. And then one day my father said, wait, you watch. Japan's going to win this war. I didn't say anything. I didn't know what to say. And then one day the sheriff came and asked us if he could take my camera and radio. He said, that's orders that he got. So I told my mother, well, that's an order. We got to do that. So we turned in our radios and our cameras, and that's all we had. So, and then he turned around and said, oh, by the way, no, you cannot speak Japanese outside. To speak Japanese inside. So I said, well, that's fine. That's what we've been doing anyway. So that's fine. And we had a curfew. We can't leave the house before 6 a.m. and we had to be home by 8 p.m. But I had a special pass being I was working at the hospital. So I had a special pass. And one day, an army train stopped at Glendive with this, three Nisei soldiers. And they heard that there was a Japanese family living in Glendive. So they said they'd like to visit the family. And at that time, my dad had just finished his job and was going to go home, and he saw them. So he brought them home, and mother gave cook and gave him a good dinner. And then one of the guys says, "Hey, tomorrow I'm going to go to Heart Mountain. I was invited to a dance. So would you like to come?" I said, "I might as well go. I'm not doing nothing else." So he went to Heart Mountain. It's at the camp near Montana. And when he got there, the soldiers were welcome. But me, as a Nisei, they all looked at me like, "Well, what is she doing here? How come she's not in here?" So I told the soldiers, "I don't feel right. So let's go home." I said, "I'm sorry, but I said, I just don't feel right." So one of the guys said, "Well, I would just a minute." So he went back in because he did have a friend there. And the friend, then he came out and he gave me this horsepin. They show the horsepin? Yeah, the horsepin. And he said, "I heard you do a lot of horseback riding, so here, you could have it. You wear it." I said, "Okay, thank you." But I don't even remember his name or anything more about him. And then another, that's one story. Should I give another story too? Okay. I have another story about my second son's name is Wendell. And my third son is over there sitting there. And he asked, "How did Wendell get his name?" So I told him, "Well, I'll tell you this." I said, "There's a young football player named Wendell, and he was a star athlete. But he wasn't doing so good in school. So one day, teacher asked me, 'Are you good in algebra? Could you help Wendell with his algebra?'" I said, "Sure, I'd love to." So I told him he had to come every day after school and for practice. But you know what? He brings his guitar, and he starts singing to me. So I said, you're here to learn algebra, not sing." And then people noticed that he was over at my house every day, every night. So they said, "Oh, she has a boyfriend." I said, "No, he's not my boyfriend. He's just a friend." He was a senior, and I was a junior. But anyway, everybody thought he was my boyfriend. And then one day, his mother asked me, "Well, everybody says my son's your boyfriend, so you marry him, huh?" She said, she's a German lady. So she tells me, "What's the matter? My boy not good enough for you?" I said, no. I said, "When I get married, I want to marry a Japanese man because I want Japanese kids. But over there's a lot of people mingling the married white guys or white dudes." But I told her, "Well, I feel like I'm Japanese. I want Japanese kids." So she said, but that's when she said, "What's the matter? My son not good enough for you." But I said, no, that's not it. But anyway, he graduated, and he went back on the football team, and he graduated. And then he got an assignment. He became a first lieutenant in the Army. And his first assignment was to go over to Germany and drop the bomb. So the poor guy, he didn't know what to do, so he wrote a note to his father and told him that, I just can't do this. I was told to bomb my mother's country, and I'm not going to do that." Next thing we know, he had taken a plane, which he's not supposed to do by himself, and he went up in the air, and he crashed, and he killed himself. But that was sad, because he said, "That's my mother's country. I cannot bomb her country." Yeah. But after a few months, the mother was still crying, and I tried to comfort her. So I told her, I said, "When I get married and have a son, I'm going to name him Wendell." Well, she said, "Oh, that's nice. Thank you," she said. And then after I got married and had my second son, I named him Wendell. So I called her right away and told her, "Well, you have a Wendell now." So she drove all the way from Glendive to Seattle all by herself to come and see her Wendell. And then one day, she was changing his diapers, and she yelled, "Shizu, Shizu, come here, quick. Look at this. My boy, all black and blue." I said, no, he's not black." And she said, "You beat him up. I'm going to call the police." I said, "No, wait a minute." I said, "That's a Japanese characteristic, that's a birthmark, that they're all black and blue, and they're wearing." But she said, "No, I don't believe you." She said, "I will call the police." She said, you beat my window, she said. Oh, she was really mad, but I won't cry. Then my husband came home and I told him, would you please explain to her that I did not beat her window? So he did, then she finally believed that, so she was fine. But that's the way it is. That's the end of that story. Now I have another story. Okay, after the war, we were asked if we would sponsor some Japanese people from camp. So we know the Higashi family and the Kawaguchi family. So my father put in a petition to have them come to Glendale, which they got the okay to leave, and they came to Glendale. And they had two daughters, so I got the two daughters a job at the hospital while I was still working there. And they lived in Sunnydale, Washington, but I don't know how they got sent down to California. Anyway, they were at the Tule Lake there, and my girlfriend there, she made me a real pretty pin out of the shell, but it's somewhere at home. I don't know where it's at, but I can't find it. Yeah. And then the oldest daughter married the Kawaguchi. That's how we invited the Kawaguchis also to come. And the youngest Kawaguchi boy was only 6 years old. So he wrote an article in one of the New York paper about his being that how that we had sponsored them to come over to Glendale. So now I don't know. They went their own way, and they being that. The Higashis and Kawaguchis were come to Ken like my mother and father were. We real good friends, so that's why they invited them to come. And they really appreciated that. But then later on they went on their own way, and we went on our way. And you know, so that's the end. Okay, that's all. That's enough.
Thank you. I'd like to introduce our next speaker is Linda Tamura. Linda Tamura is a Sansei who was raised on a farm in Hood River, Oregon. Her father was a veteran of the war, and Linda conducted extensive oral histories with the veterans, their families, and members of the community. She had access to hundreds of recently uncovered letters and documents from private files of a local veterans group that led the campaign against the Japanese-American soldiers. Her book, Nisei Soldiers Break Their Silence, Coming Home to Hood River Valley, has just been published by the University of Washington Press. This book also includes the little-known story of local Nisei veterans who spent 40 years appealing their convictions for insubordination. Linda Tamura was a professor of education at Willamette University in Salem, Oregon, and she is the author of the book The Hood River Issei, An Oral History of Japanese Settlers in Oregon's Hood River Valley. And I greatly admire her work, the persistence and ability to secure these extensive oral histories that she has made available to others to also mine the research that she's done. It was at a crucial time when so many of the Issei had been passing away, so we really owe her a lot that she was able to do these in-depth interviews. And then to follow it up now with the story of the Nisei in Hood River Valley. So she will be talking about the Hood River Nisei, their pre-war life during the war and into the east of the exclusion zone. Okay, Linda?
Why don't we have Shiz tell another story?
Another story?
Did you tell them further about the soldiers?
About
the other soldiers? I mean, when they went there?
You know, what Shiz says is that when she went to the camp with the soldiers, remember that they had gone through, they were on the train, and they stopped in Glendive, and her family was able to take them in. And they found out that there was that dance in Heart Mountain. So they somehow rented or got a car, and they drove down there. So she tells us about how, for the first time, she was just shocked to see 10,000 Japanese Americans. And she had known, you know, the crushing news about all of their friends and relatives on the West Coast. This was happening. And to see it, you know, in the face like that was just overwhelming for her. So she sort of went quickly through that, but it's left her with this deep, in some ways, trauma, I think, ever since. The knowledge that here she was free every day, living a small-town life with other, you know, German-Americans, Italian-Americans that understood that they were still American. And then to go and see all of her American friends of Japanese ancestry in this enclosure and not understanding how that can happen. And so that's always lived with her. And that's why somehow that horse pin, she could never wear it, but she could never throw it away either. And so we have that horsepin and that story in the Japanese Cultural and Community Center of Washington Art Behind Barbed Wire exhibit. And when you look at it, it looks like just a simple pin, but you need to know the depth of that story there of what that horse meant. And I think in some ways that horse was like that symbol of freedom. It said that much of the carvings that men did in the camps were birds, and people said it's like, the birds could come into the camp and they could fly out, even in the desert heat, I suppose. But for Shiz, that horse, I mean, that every day she could have a freedom of riding, and to know that the horse was carved in an incarceration camp. So that's lived with her for quite some time. Am I not saying it correctly, the story?
Well, actually, when I was growing up, I had lots of fun there in a small town of Cleveland. Everybody knew everybody. They knew who you went out with, who you came home with, which that part I didn't care for. But we never locked our doors there in Glendale. We don't see our neighbors. We say, yoo-hoo, and they open the door. And then if she's in bed, we go home and make soup and take the soup to her. And everybody took care of everybody. They took care of the kids, yelled at other people's kids. They yelled at me, too. And we just one big happy family there. Everybody, like I said, everybody knew everybody. But I used to go horseback riding and roller skating, and we had square dancing and mountain climbing. And I enjoyed all of that. I was very active, but now I'm not that active.
Yes, you are. You're always volunteering. But as she said in the session before, that ironically, growing up in that small town in Montana, she didn't suffer the kind of day-to-day kind of prejudice. Mm-hmm. And she came face-to-face, of course, when she went to Heart Mountain and when she returned to living in Seattle. And then she was marked as being looking like the enemy in many ways. And there in Montana, they recognized her as an American citizen. So that's kind of a difference there. Of course, there are other east of the exclusion zones stories. A friend just talked to me yesterday about her mother, who couldn't come to the conference today. She grew up in Spokane, and she said that as a child, she had many, many, as they say, Hakujin friends. But after Pearl Harbor, they all shunned her. And so the lesson that she told her daughter was that choose your friends and consider your friends very, very carefully, because when a crisis occurs, suddenly so-called friends may disappear. So know who your true friends are. But her mother had great friendships after that, but it was a very traumatic thing as a child, you know, growing up in Spokane, to suddenly lose that. Another Nisei friend I know, every day that he went to school, his parents insisted that he go to school. Gangs of kids would beat him up every day, going to school and coming back. So I'm not sure why he became a teacher and devoted himself to multicultural education. Perhaps I understand that, but I can't imagine that throughout the whole war, every day going to school meant getting beaten up. So I think everybody should have moved to Glendive, Montana. I think we're ready with Linda's.
Thanks for your patience. This is what we call gammon for sure. Homer Yasui told me that he says that Nisei are highly ambivalent. He says, we don't know what we are or where we fit in. And he believes that because Nisei were pulled in many directions during the war. And I think that's especially true for those who were resettling outside the exclusion zone. because while the government was promoting that encouraging Nikkei to migrate eastward and promoting their assimilation by going to school or by working, at the same time, there was a hidden message because, of course, the overt message was that Nikkei were being resettled because they were placed in camps and they were encouraged to resettle because, in fact, they were suspicious. They could not live on the West Coast. So therein lies a lot of the contradictions, that they looked differently and they were not considered safe enough to live along the West Coast. So what I'd like to do is to examine the effects of resettlement through the stories of four Nisei from rural Hood River in Oregon and their work and their schooling, and then their return to a valley which was very hostile to Japanese Americans during the wartime period. The four that I'm profiling, each of them was incarcerated in camp. Each left to go to work or to school. And then each returned to life in Oregon. And while during the war they complied, in effect later on they found other ways to speak out and to speak up about what had occurred to them. So we'll look at life in Hood River, at their exodus from camp, at their resettlement, and then their return. So we'll begin with Hood River, which is the community where I was raised. Hood River was a small community nestled at the foot of Mount Hood, at the nexus of the Hood River and the Columbia River. And you'll see that Mount Hood actually had a lot of impact on this valley because the rich basaltic soil came, in fact, from the rock, viscous rock, from the eruptions of Mount Hood. So from the 1890s, in fact, Hood River had an international reputation for the quality of its apples. In fact, that lured even East Coast families to come to Hood River to buy property that was wooded, and then they wanted a piece of the action. They wanted to become farmers of Hood River apples. Well, there was a challenge because, in fact, many of those East Coast families sent their sons who were Ivy League graduates, and they were very smart, but they didn't have a lot of hands-on work ethic. So that's where the Issei came in. They happened to be working on the railroads, and they were in Hood River about that time. And so many Hood River property owners lured the Issei by telling them, if you will clear 15 acres for us, we'll give you 5 acres. What a deal. It was 5 acres of swampland or stump land or marshland, but in fact it was 5 acres just the same. And so the Issei took on the job of felling the logs. Some of them were so huge that 3 people could surround them with their arms, and then pulling the logs away with horsepower, and then dynamiting the stumps. And that was so dangerous, in fact, that a number of Nisei or of Issei lost their jobs. As a result, then, people like my grandfather, although this is not his photo, this is the Endo family, by the way, and the Endos are here, the Endo family is here, they worked 7 days a week, 5 days working for someone else, and then 2 days working with others on their own property. They became economically prosperous. In fact, by 1920, the Hood River Japanese owned more than half of the property owned by Japanese in Oregon. And by 1940, even though the Nikkei, those of Japanese descent, were only composed 0.5% of the population in the valley, in fact, they produced 25% of the fruit. And part of that, you'll see that as the young seedlings were growing, the families were raising strawberries and asparagus as quick cash crops in between. So they became an economic threat. The other thing that you'll see is Mrs. Endo was working. Also, the family, the children, were working as well. On May 13, 1942, the Japanese Americans from Hood River boarded a train and headed to camp. They didn't know where they were going. They ended up going to Pinedale Assembly Center in Northern California and then to Tule Lake. And after the loyalty oath, some of them then went to either Minidoka in Idaho or Heart Mountain in Wyoming. Min Asai was 24, and he was the third of eight children. He had studied chemistry at Linfield College and Oregon State College, but his family was not able to continue to send him to school. So he came back and he worked on the farm until the family joined Hood River Nikkei to go to the camps in 1942. He said, camp life was boring and useless. He had a job loading and unloading food boxes, and he wanted to do something productive, something much more constructive with his life. Now, at that time, the Western Defense Command, which was charged with implementing Executive Order 9066, had received requests from farmers to employ the Nikkei during their seasonal farm labor. They were concerned that their crops, especially the sugarcane, was going to be lost because they didn't have employees. But they also saw that Japanese Americans could be a source of cheap labor. So after the Utah sugar beet farmers put out the first call for laborers, Min was among the first to leave Pinedale Assembly Center. And he did that on July 3rd, 1942, just 5 days after he had arrived. And so for a year, he worked in the sugar beet fields and also in the sugar factory in the lab. In fact, by the end of 1942, 10,000 Japanese Americans from the camps were working in the western states. Min's younger sister, Mika, was 18 years old when the family left for Pinedale and then Tule Lake. She tried to make the best of it. And she said, we did just what the government told us to do. Actually, she went to Heart Mountain, excuse me. And at Heart Mountain in 1944, she joined 9 Nisei women, and she picked potatoes for the first time. And this was at a Wyoming farm. She said the Hakujin farmer picked them up every day at the camp, and he was very good. She earned 50 cents an hour and used her $50 wages to buy an overcoat. In 1944, when Mika was 20, she left Heart Mountain to attend the Latter-day Saints Business School College in Salt Lake City. Thank you. Her brother Half was serving in the military, and so he sent half of the $21 Army stipend to his father, and Mr. Asai gave it to Mika so she could use it for spending money when she went to school. Oops, there she is in Salt Lake City at college. Bessie Watanabe, also from Hood River, was the eldest of three, and she had planned to go to Oregon State College to major in secretarial science. She said, Tule Lake was awful. The living conditions were poor. There was nothing to do except attend sewing classes, read, and work in the mess hall. This is Bessie right here. And as you can see, she doesn't look real happy. She said that her father also recognized that camp wasn't a good place, and he said, you should go to school and learn something. So he made arrangements for her also to go to the LDS Business School, and she and Mika went together. And this was just 2 months after she had arrived at Tule Lake. Going to Salt Lake City, she said, was kind of scary, but her father must have been thinking about her future. She said, he made all the decisions, and we followed. Bessie is right here, and Mika is here. And at school, they mingled with Japanese Americans from Portland and Seattle, but they really didn't have Hakujin friends at school. After school, they studied and they worked together, and they each lived with a Hakujin family, and they said the families treated them very well. So being Japanese American was fine. After a year and a half of school, Bessie was hired as a secretary with the Utah Lumber Company, and all of her employees and friends were Hakujin. Historian Leonard Arrington has said that the reception of Japanese Americans in Utah may have been better than other states. In fact, in 1942, they did a survey of 5,000 Utahns and found that two-thirds actually approved of permitting Nisei to work outside. Only 18% approved of Issei, but they were definitely supportive of Nisei. And there's speculation, of course, that Mormon settlers in Utah shared some of the shared different values, just as Japanese Americans did, and the government was trying to pressure them to adopt predominant American values. So that was something that they did have in common. Homer Yasui found camp very exciting. This is him in Denver and actually not in camp. But he had never been in the presence of so many Nihonjin who, he said, ate like me, looked like me, smelled like me, and he even avoided the last month of school. He was only 17, and he and his younger sister lived with his mother in a unit. His father had been sent to a Justice Department internment center, and his older brother and wife lived in a different unit. So Homer ran around with friends. He ate at their mess halls. He said he never once ate with his family. And away from home, of course, he didn't have to work on the stupid farm. His father, though, had another view because he recognized right away that camp life was not a good environment for his son because he saw Homer running around with a bunch of rowdy boys, playing baseball all the time, ogling the girls, getting into fights, smoking cigarettes, and messing around. So his mother and his older sister worked with the National Japanese American Student Relocation Council to get Homer out of camp. And in fact, they helped 4,000 to relocate to more than 600 schools east of the exclusion zone. At school, to qualify for school, Homer had to be accepted by a college. He needed to have clearance from the FBI. He needed to have approval from his high school principal, and he had to recognize that he had government-approved housing. And the family chose the University of Denver because he had siblings attending summer school there. At the University of Denver, Homer spent all of his time with Nisei. In fact, he says he can't recall the name of one single Caucasian student, though he remembers the looks and the sounds of scores of Nisei. There were only about 200 of the 2,000 students who were Nisei, and he chose Nisei friends because he said, "I didn't know if I fit in with the Hakujin crowd. Mostly we stuck to ourselves and studied." He graduated from the University of Denver in 3 years, and even though he applied to 10 medical schools, he was accepted at only one in Philadelphia. After graduating from Hahnemann Medical College with his medical degree in 1949, he completed an internship in Milwaukee and a residency in New York. He and Mickey, and they're both here today, married in 1950, and then he returned to the West Coast. He ended up completing residencies and a tour of duty at hospitals in Portland, and then he spent 2 years as a Navy Medical Corps surgeon. The family returned to Portland, and he said, "We didn't face discrimination, but then we stayed away from places and people whom we thought might not welcome us." I asked him then, "So why didn't you go back to Hood River because that was your hometown?" And Homer told me, "I was disgusted with the Hood River people. I didn't have to return to Hood River to live with a bunch of bigots and hypocrites, so I didn't." So what happened in Hood River to create national notoriety, in fact, for this small community? Well, a veterans group had proposed an amendment to the Constitution that would deny citizenship not just to the Issei, the first generation, but also to the Nisei, who were born as American citizens. You'll see the side of the courthouse in downtown Hood River, and along the top and the side is a memorial board, and that included the names of 1,600 who were serving in the military services from Hood River. In November 29, 1944, the names of 16 were removed, and these were all Japanese Americans who were serving in our United States military. This immediately brought national notoriety to Hood River. There were editorials in newspapers all over the country, including this one from Collier's, the Chicago Sun-Times, the Chicago Tribune, the New York Times. There were letters that were sent from military and citizens from across the country to Hood River. And a national a newspaper poll of residents in Hood River showed that 84% actually didn't want Japanese to return. There also were full-page advertisements. This was one stating residents' concerns about the return of the Nikkei, and underneath were the names of citizens who purportedly were stating that they, too, believed that Japanese Americans should not return, and there was a total of 1,610 names included there. So in 1945, going back to our Nisei, Min Eisai was working in Chicago. He'd left the sugar beet fields, and he was making eyeglasses in Chicago, but he was also taking classes at night because he wanted to become a chemist. Two of his brothers' names had been removed from the honor roll on the courthouse. Min was one of the first three to return to Hood River in January 1945. And you'll see this is actually taken from a newspaper because the return of Nikkei to Hood River became a nationwide noteworthy piece of news. People wondered what was going to happen to them. Would they be received? In fact, there were claims that there would be reception committees to turn them back. Min recalled that when he returned, children jeered him. Stores would not sell goods to him. Friends avoided him. And the American Legion, the veterans group I mentioned, sent agents to try to purchase the Eisai Orchard, and he ran them off. He couldn't buy vehicles. He needed to buy a car and a truck. He had to go to Boise, Idaho, in order to make his purchases. There was another worry because Min, in fact, had been reclassified from 4C to 1A, and so now he was eligible for the draft, and he would be drafted shortly. So his parents and Mika and two school-age brothers returned to Hood River to operate the farm. They were harassed. Locals stole gas from their pumps and tools from their woodshed. And they had a display of a five-star flag, and this was to commemorate that there are five sons serving in the military. And someone came and threw a huge rock through that window. Bessie Eisai's family also asked her to return home, even though she didn't want to, but they needed her help on the farm. And in fact, only 40% of Hood River Nikkei returned to the valley, and that is compared to higher statistics, for example, 60% in the Seattle area. So how did life outside the exclusion zone affect the post-war lives of these Nisei? Mika Eisai acquired shorthand and typing skills when she went to business school. After marrying and settling in Ontario, Oregon, in eastern Oregon, Mika Eisai Huga was hired as a secretary at Orida Farms, or Orida Foods, which became Heinz, and she spent 25 years working in their personnel department. She told me, "My life went from bad to good. Business school afforded opportunities for her." And she said, "I felt lucky I could get out of camp to go to school. In fact, by 1970, more than half of Japanese Americans had white-collar jobs, and that was higher than the percentage for white males at that time. Bessie Asai worked as a receptionist at Webster Packing House in Hood River for about a year, and then she married Min Asai and became very active in the community. Homer Yasui became a surgeon in Portland, and as I mentioned before, he was conflicted because he said Nisei are very highly ambivalent. They may be even warped. Here he was raised with obligations in an Issei family. Don't work, work hard with diligence. Don't bring shame to the family. Don't waste time or money. And yet there was a dilemma because that was very different from much of the Hagujin culture that he encountered. They said grace before every meal. They said excuse me before they sneezed or before they farted. And he said when he went to school, the Nisei kids, when they had to go to the bathroom, they'd get up and they'd leave. And they got in trouble for that because the teacher said, well, no, you have to ask permission. So he said there were so many ways, and those are small ways, when the Nisei really were conflicted. In fact, there are other scholars who affirm that. Alan Austin has said that Nisei students' burden was that they were supposed to be ambassadors of goodwill, the model minority stereotype. And Lane Hirabayashi has talked about the WRA's goal of assimilation. It might even be viewed as cultural destruction. There are others, and I won't mention them, but I will say that Harry Kitano, about 15 years ago, talked about the fact that Nisei really now want to provide a legacy for future generations. So I'd like to go back to the Nisei then and focus on how they have spoken out in their own ways. Homer Yasui said, well, you know, in the past, we didn't speak up because we were afraid. In the tempo of time, I probably wouldn't have done anything different, especially coming from rural Hood River. But today, he says, we have a moral obligation to speak up when things are wrong. We have to make hard choices sometimes. And he has served as the governor of the Pacific Northwest District of JCL, the Japanese American Citizens League. He was on the committee for the JACL for redress, and he chaired the national committee to support his brother Min Yasui's Coram Nobis case. Mika Asai Hyuga regularly gives talks to schools, and she also speaks to visiting groups at the Four Rivers Cultural Center in Ontario. She recognizes that at that time, she did what they had to do. But now, she tells me, I want them to know what happened to us. I don't want it to happen to anybody else. Bessie Watanabe Asai regularly volunteers with schools, and she was instrumental in helping to prepare a permanent exhibit at the Hood River Museum. Her comments, it shouldn't happen again anyplace. And I'd like to finish with Min Asai, who died in 2002, at Bessie's husband, and he's spoken many times to high school students. I think his words convey the message of Mika, Bessie, and Homer. The national government has tried to rectify some of their mistakes, but it can never erase the shame that America caused by evacuating and placing some of their citizens in concentration camps for no other reason than their ancestry. Let us be sure that incidents like this do not happen again. Thank you.
We're going to open up for comments and questions. I just wanted to sort of add one thing. Robert Sims from Boise State has written extensively on the Japanese American experience. And one of the more interesting kinds of research he's done was looking at the free zone You know, that is the area that was unaffected by exclusion. So that would be like east of the Columbia River in Washington, for instance. And he mainly was writing about those in Idaho. And an interesting thing that he brought up was, what is the impact of the incarceration camp being in Minidoka in Idaho, and then surrounding areas? There had been farmers, Japanese-American farmers, in that area. So he started to interview them. And it was an interesting kind of a research that most people hadn't looked at, to see what their lives were like, how they were impacted, how the neighbors began to view them in different ways, and then to move in 10,000-plus Japanese-Americans from the West Coast in these camps, and there they were still farming outside. And he looked at also what happened after the camps too, the kinds of ways of attention between those that resettled out of the camp and then those that had never been in the camp. And so many of you maybe in the audience now might start to think about those kinds of relationships, if you can think about yourself or your families after the camp. Interactions with those in the free zone versus those that were in camp. We can start our conversations about people that left camp to go to the Midwest or in Denver or the Midwest or the East Coast, those kinds of experiences, and the return. So let me open that up, and you have questions for our speakers, or you have comments. And if you do so, could you make sure that we have Eric there? He has the microphone. If you raise your hand and speak into the mic so that we can record it. Even if you have a loud voice, if you don't speak into the mic, it won't be recorded. Linda is asking, was there anybody that lived in the free zone or left camp in the audience, or your families? During the camp, if you lived in the free zone and never were in camp, or your family left. Okay, so there's quite a few.
Those are the stories we want to
hear. Yeah. So where was your family? Oh, I'm sorry.
Hi, I'm Janet Carlson. My mother grew up in Lingle, Wyoming, in a community along the Platte River, the Oregon Trail, and so she never left camp. And apparently there were encounters with Heart Mountain people and so on. I did interview about a dozen people in that area that were Nisei and Sansei, and basically everybody left because of the racism that they experienced while they were growing up. There's hardly anyone left in that valley of Japanese descent, but at the time of the war, there was actually a church in Mitchell, Nebraska, where my parents were ultimately married. So there's a priest there, you know, that's keeping the community together. It was quite a vibrant community, but has since fallen apart.
Say that again. Is that Wyoming or Nebraska?
It's on the border. You know, the Oregon Trail goes by Chimney Rock and Scott's Bluff, and then there's Register Cliff is in Wyoming. And so this valley was irrigated by waters held back by a dam, and the Japanese community seemed pretty, you know, large by Minnesota standards, where I live, you know, the geographic area, but these people all attended church in Mitchell, Nebraska.
Was there somebody else? We'll get to this side of the house.
Hi, my name is Mike Yanagita, and I grew up in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And not too many people know, but there was a small military language school at the University of Michigan during the war. So a small Japanese community ended up in Ann Arbor during the war. And then I also had two great uncles that ended up immigrating to Fargo, North Dakota prior to the war. They opened up a truck stop coffee shop. And so they, I don't know what's better, to be in Fargo, North Dakota, or to be in camp, but... But during the war, they ended up hiring many Issei out of the camp to work in this coffee shop. So at one point, my uncle told me that they had 26 cooks working in the small truck stop coffee shop during the war. So
that's like Shiz's family sponsoring so many families out
right,
of the camp.
Right.
So this coffee shop sponsored needed help, 26
right,
cooks.
It was 24/7 coffee shop. It was truck stop coffee shop. So they had... men cooking all day long.
You know, I taught at the University of Michigan, so I did some, wherever I teach, I like to know what happened intersecting with Asian American history. And in Ann Arbor, it's quite interesting that the university itself refused Japanese American students. So they were all gone. But they had the Japanese language school. So suddenly, many of course, the instructors were Issei and Nisei. Right. And so the school had to suddenly handle maybe 150, I think, Japanese Americans descending. And it was difficult for them to rent. And so they had to find housing for the Japanese Americans there. Many of them remained in Ann Arbor and the surrounding area. But rejecting Japanese American students, because one of the famous ones, if you're from the Seattle area, you might know Kikuchi. He tried to get admitted to grad school, to transfer grad school to University of Michigan, and all those years he kept the letter of rejection, and the letter said it didn't deny him transfer, but it said, if you can prove that you are not of Japanese ancestry, we will accept you. So later he was a very famous physicist, and he was hired by the University of Michigan. And on the day that he retired, he gave his letter of retirement to his chair and dean, who became president of the University of Michigan. And in it, he showed a copy of the rejection letter. And, you know, this guy won some kind of a Nobel Prize or something in ruby laser research and all of that. But it remained with him all that time. He was able to actually graduate from the University of Washington in the end, but so that's Ann Arbor.
I was actually in Roar and Gila, but I married a man who was born in Lima, Ohio, whose father was in the vaudeville troupe of Blackstone the Magician, and he established a restaurant in Lima, Ohio. But my name is spelled Inoway, which is not the usual way to spell Inoue. But in 1920, he had the name anglicized because in the vaudeville troupe, nobody could pronounce Inoue when it was spelled Inoue. So we have researched the history, and there is evidence of, I mean, the town of Lima, Ohio is very proud of this man who became the president of the Kiwanis Club. He established something like Little League Baseball. He did a lot of things. But then after I got married, I lived in Salt Lake City and was surrounded by people who never went to camp. And so their experience as Japanese Americans is very different. And I came here thinking that I might meet somebody from Salt Lake, and I have not yet found one. But I think it's because most of them were not connected with the internment experience and incarceration. So
we left Amachi, Colorado, and we went to farm in Utah. And I found that the treatment of Japanese Americans differ depending on which town you were in. We first went to Spanish Fork, which is south of Provo, and I was in school. I was in sixth grade. There were three of us cousins in the same class, because when we moved, all the family got together. So there were three of us cousins, same age, and we were in the same class. Well, in Spanish Fork, we were treated all right. There was no problem. Then we moved to American Fork, which is north of Provo. And my uncles and my grandparents were in Lehi, which is next town. Well, they didn't have any problem in Lehi. But in American Fork, I was treated not very nice. Classmates would throw rocks at me when I'm riding a bicycle. They wanted to drown me in the swimming pool. And this was even after my cousin finished basic training and came to speak at our class before he went overseas. and he was actually killed in Italy. But so depending on the town that you were in, you were treated differently. So I guess it's just that some instigator, there'll be somebody that does it and then everybody follows. So so that's my story.
Well, I was just a toddler in Minidoka. But our family was one of the early families, I think, to leave the camp in 1943, because my father was bilingual, and so he went to teach MIS soldiers at Fort Snelling, Minnesota. But my late father-in-law was from Pendleton, Oregon, and that was outside the exclusion zone. So he was a celebrated boxer, a Nisei boxer, Hal Hoshino, and his fiancée was put into the Gila camp. She was from Pasadena, and I mean, that was my mother-in-law. And he was allowed to go and visit her at Gila and then leave because he was from Pendleton and not incarcerated. But that's our story anyway.
I went to a CWRIC hearing on Capitol Hill in Washington in the 1980s. And afterwards, I went to a Mushroom Club meeting. And I told the club mycologist, you know, where I'd been and why I was late. And he said, well, he had a confession that he grew up in a small town in Idaho. And when he was ready to graduate from high school, he should have been the salutatorian, and the valedictorian was a Japanese-American girl, but the Board of Education would not allow her to be the valedictorian, so he became the valedictorian. So I just always thought it was interesting that, I mean, I'd never heard of a situation like that before, but I'm sure that happened frequently.
Hi. I grew up in Ontario, Oregon, and my family went there. We're in Heart Mountain. And then they went to Ontario because they heard it was friendly, more friendly than other places, and there were already Japanese homesteaders there. So they were kind of welcomed in the community. And growing up, it was a very large Japanese-American community. We had a Buddhist temple, judo club, everything. And I remember when I was a student in the 60s, the junior college was formed, and the president that was elected to the board was a Nisei from the 447th.
My name is Barbara Haruchi. My dad was in Heart Mountain and with his family. He's from Eastern Washington. He tells me stories of when they were in camp, he and his brother hardly spent any time in camp because they would go out and pick sugar beets in Dakotas and freezing and made it all the way to Chicago, worked in a dog food factory, a mattress factory, and they would come back and then go back out again. So they spent very little time in camp. But he would say that they would meet other Japanese people who weren't incarcerated. And it's like, you know, what delineated the line of where they decided that, you know, and it was kind of for a young man who's, you know, in his late teens, it was kind of confusing for him. That, you know, it's like who made these geographic lines? I mean, he talked about that. I mean, and going to Chicago and like other people saying different cities or even within Chicago being chased by people, you know, because they thought they were Chinese, but then they find out they're Japanese. And so, I was wondering about the people who lived outside the exclusion area. The Japanese American people, how is it their livelihood affected by the war there economically? Was it impacted by prejudice or was it again dependent on the region? You know, if you had a farm, would people stop buying from you? You know, or if you had a business. I mean, it sounds like it was dependent on the area, but I wondered if anyone has ever done any kind of studies about the economic impact of Japanese Americans outside of camp during the wartime.
Well, I think that's where Robert Sims' research on that comes in.
Is he doing like a book now or study research on it now? Or
I'm not sure if he's published the book, but he's published many articles on that. But there are others that have written in different areas. And it could be, like you were saying, just a neighboring town, the culture that would allow such a thing. Or in Shiz's case, German-American, Italian-American families realizing, as she had said, that we have connections to that old country. We understand that it's the politicians, it's the government officials that are doing this, not us, and we recognize ourselves as part of America. And so certainly they didn't do the blame game on Shiz, and Shiz didn't say the same thing to them as Italians and Germans in that town. But you could move that town to a next one, and you could have a different culture there. But some, as I understand it, some Japanese-American businesses and farms and so forth suffered, and others were supported by their communities. It all depended. Now, in Ontario, you were talking about that. You saw that museum that they have, the Three Culture or Three Forks? Four Forks, yeah. And what they recognize is that the Japanese Americans that came to work in the field saved the harvest, right? And so there was this kind of a community spirit of one helping each other and that recognition. So I asked some of the Nisei, why do you stay? Oh, I'm sorry, this is being recorded. I mean, why do you stay there? And you know, the town was good and the community was good to them. They gave back, and they received much also. So I think it just depended.
Thank you. I'm Barbara Bellis. I lived in Ontario from 1989 to 1995. And during that time, the Four Rivers Cultural Center, we got the grant to do that. And actually, the money came from the military allotment because we had the 442nd connection. And the Oregon was last in military spending, and they needed to do more military spending in Oregon. And so the reason that I think it was a couple of $1 million was given was because of the war record of the 442nd and the 100th, and there were a lot of veterans and a lot of Kibe in that particular community as well. And then the committee realized that when Japanese Americans, veterans, and others came, they said, we don't want it just to focus on us. And it became a broader history of the region, and also just it starts with the geological formation of the valley and Four Rivers and all this sort of stuff. And there was this sense of that's why the money came, and it should be included, otherwise we might be in trouble. But this desire, which I thought is a really interesting dynamic in terms of the community, and it provides really in Ontario still the best public theater facility in the whole area. And it's enabled certain things to happen. But that's where the money came from, which was a pretty interesting dynamic.
I think we need to end, but if there's just one more comment.
My name is Stan Umeda, and from Sacramento, California. And we went to Jerome and other camps. But I want to do is convey a story of a friend of ours whose parents worked in the railroad industry in Nevada. And when war broke out, they were summarily fired. And so all of a sudden, this family had no way of providing for the family. Well, the way they coped is that one of the daughters was a beautician, and at evening time, she would be a hairdresser for the persons that worked in the casinos. And the son, who was in high school, would be stock the grocery store in the middle of the night when nobody could see that he was working there. And so that's the way they coped because they were fired. Also, this family visited from Nevada to Tule Lake relatives in camp. And they asked to stay. Said no. They got kicked out because they got rejected from Tule Lake because they were living in Nevada. The other part of the story is that they visited by car, And tires were, you know, rationed at that point, and they had thread-worn tires. And the people in camp said, you can't go back to, you know, ride back there. I said, nah, that's the way it came. Well, when they got, you know, the next day when they left, thanks to a miraculous evolution, all of the tires were replaced, and they were returned back to Nevada. So those are some of the interesting stories of how we coped with these adverse times. Oh, the tires, thanks to the military.
Well, thank you very much, and the two speakers will remain for you to talk with them. So let's give a hand to Shiz and Linda.